tethered. We've got the usual array, about, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 cameras on tripods and another couple on people's shoulders. Media has gathered. Representatives of Exxon Shipping Company and the industry response team are present, and the crowd of the room is filling up with members of the press, also members of the Valdez and Cordova communities. Today we have had, of course, a briefing by Exxon earlier in the day, a short one by Frank Iarossi, the president of Exxon Shipping. We've also had briefings by representatives from the Department of the Interior, from the Coast Guard, and this morning a very short conference by the NTSB, basically defining what their role in the on the upcoming investigation will be, and clarifying that the Coast Guard or other jurisdictional agencies will be the ones who actually determine what, if any, penalties, fines, or legal actions will be brought against members of the crew of the Exxon Valdez or other parties involved with the grounding. The NTSB is basically here, we were told, simply to investigate the and determine what events led specifically to the grounding and to make recommendations to prevent such a grounding from occurring again. The day has been a windy one, not much good news to report. The wind has driven the oil slick to the southwest across Prince William Sound. We now have oil on the beaches on several of the Sound Islands. Heavy oiling has been reported on both Sisters Islands and on Seal Island. Also, oil has been in evidence on Eleanor Island and Naked Island. We can assume that Night Island will soon be involved in the oil on the beaches as well. We will hear a report tonight on the effect of on the attempts today to use dispersants. The press conference was postponed from 6 until 8, ostensibly to allow further testing of dispersants.
Cornette, I'm the Alaska coordinator for Exxon, and I manage the Exxon office in Anchorage. I've lived in Alaska for about 2.5 years. C-O-R-N-E-T-T. We're not trying to run a new face in on you here. I've been asked to come down and assist Frank. He's talking so much that his voice is giving out, and he also needs to spend as much time as he can on the job at hand. So I'm going to try to be helping him with answering some of the questions that you have and getting the information out to you as we get it. First, I would like to announce that tomorrow evening's press conference will be a one-hour press conference at 5 o'clock. The reason for that is we're going over to Cordova for a town meeting. Maybe we'll come back and have one the next day, but we have promised to be there, and everybody's going to leave, so get your questions ready, and we'll do that in 1 hour. Also, Frank asked me to pass on to those of you, he's had many, many nice letters and calls and comments and helpful suggestions from people, and asked me to thank those people that have done that. And he had one letter in particular that meant a lot to him. It's from the division manager, Mr. C. Burkholt. I don't know Mr. Burkholt, maybe some of you do. He manages Alaska sightseeing tours, derives a lot of his livelihood from tours in the Prince William Sound, operates a vessel called the Glacier Seas, I think. It says, hang in there. We understand the enormity of the task at hand. We appreciate and support your ability to pull the teams and resources together and wish you the success and good luck you'll need to overcome it. Rest well when you can so that you may maximize your personal efforts. We appreciate that very much. That's the only one I'm going to read. Now, we have a statement that I would like to read, because there are a couple of issues that keep coming up, and I will deal with them tonight, and then hopefully we can deal with the oil spill. We are spending an awful lot of time talking, and we need to spend a lot more time working. Exxon Shipping Company summarized the results of its internal investigation of the grounding of the tanker Exxon Valdez on a reef in Prince William Sound off southern Alaska early last Friday. Exxon Shipping Company determined that all mechanical systems and electronic systems on the ship were fully operational. The investigation has focused on the actions of the ship's captain, the officer on watch, and the helmsman from the time the pilot was disembarked until the vessel went aground. This was a period of 40 minutes during which time the vessel moved approximately 8 miles. The Exxon Valdez was maneuvering to avoid ice in the shipping lanes at the time the vessel went aground on Bligh Reef. At the time of the grounding, the ship's captain was not on the bridge. The third mate had the watch and was in control of the ship. We will have copies of this statement to hand out to you later, so but I will read it to you. Exxon Shipping Company emphasized it is cooperating with the National Transportation Safety Board investigation in Alaska, which began on Monday. The company said while the National Transportation Safety Board investigation is ongoing, it is inappropriate for Exxon to comment any further on the events involving the accident itself. Exxon Shipping said its ongoing priorities are to clean up the spilled oil, transfer the remaining crude from the Valdez to the Exxon Baton Rouge and other Exxon vessels to prevent further spilling and then to salvage the Valdez. The company said it cannot yet provide an estimate of the costs associated with oil spill cleanup and vessel damage since the cleanup effort and the damage assessment are still in their early stages. Exxon Shipping said it will bear the cost of any repairs to the vessel. The cargo owner, Exxon Company USA, will bear the cost of the lost cargo. The cost of the pollution cleanup and related third-party claims will be handled through insurance companies covering Exxon Shipping Company or through payments by cooperative associations established for this purpose or by a combination of these coverages. Exxon Shipping said it currently has personnel in Alaska who are authorized to handle claims as quickly as possible. That is the end of the statement, and that is what we know about the captain and what led up to the accident, and we will not be making comments on that or answering questions on that until the investigations are completed, and I believe that you can understand the reason behind that. The other issue that I want to talk about just a little bit, because the fact that it's getting so much play in the news, is dispersants. I'd like to go through just a couple of points. One of the things that I think that we tend to forget is that oil is biodegradable. The purpose of dispersant is to enhance the biodegradability of the oil. When oil is spilled on water, the first thing that happens is a portion of it evaporates. A smaller portion is dissolved in the water. And what is remaining on the surface, if it is just left alone and not recovered mechanically or treated in any way, is eventually degraded through bacterial action. What the purpose of dispersants is to break up that oil into small, very small droplets that enhances the evaporation, the solution in the water, and the ability of the bacteria to get to the oil. Dispersants are not intended to sink the oil, make it go below the surface, put it on the bottom. It is strictly to enhance the biodegradability of the oil. Dispersants got a bad name many years ago because when we first started having oil spills and became a major problem, we ran out with everything from Tide to the early oil spill detergents, and they were very harsh, and they were almost immediately banned by the EPA and by most of the environmental departments of the states. We have worked for many, many years to get dispersants developed that the Environmental Protection Agency will approve, that will meet the standards of your Department of Environmental Conservation in Alaska. We're at that point. Dispersants are a key part of the Prince William oil spill contingency plan. When you have a spill of the magnitude that we have had here, the plan relies very heavily on the use of dispersants. Now, the reason that we have a plan is so that we don't have to debate whether we're going to execute parts of that plan at the height of a crisis. And that's what we've been doing for the last 2 or 3 days, and especially in the media. If the EPA and the Department of Environmental Conservation and the Coast Guard and NOAA did not approve of the use of dispersants, we would not use them. We feel that they were not safe, they would not have approved of them. So they are part of the plan, and it is our plan, as long as they are approved, to execute that plan as fully as we can. That is all that I have to say on disbursements. If you want to dig deeper into disbursements, the Environmental Protection Agency has analyzed not only Corexit 9527, but every disbursement that is approved that's manufactured by anybody. And they have all that information. It is available to you. I do not have it, but if I had it, I don't have the time, and we don't have the time, and we shouldn't take the time at this point with the oil on the water and the effort that is underway to debate that issue. So we would like to move on now and discuss what we're doing on the oil spill and what the prognosis is, and take your questions.
Since
1980. Let me first say, could I go through an update? Can I take a statement? That's the format we followed every time. I got more notes. At the start of this incident, we were faced with three tasks. Individually, each one of them was enormous. Taking them concurrently is just something no one ever contemplated having to face. The first task is that 240,000 barrels of oil had been released into Prince William Sound in a period of approximately 3 hours after the grounding. And that's the Coast Guard's estimate on the time. The damaged vessel was resting on a rock pinnacle approximately at its longitudinal and transverse midpoint. The vessel contained 1 million barrels of oil and 5 undamaged tanks and 8 damaged tanks. And the damaged tanks actually was in the form of a layer of seawater at the bottom of the tank, a layer of oil at the top of the tank, and an interface layer of oily water mixture. I want to update you on the progress in all three of these areas, all three of these threats. As an overview, our response in two of the three areas, is proceeding very well, and we are increasingly confident we have a good chance to transfer the million barrels off the damaged vessel and to safely refloat the vessel. Both tasks, by the way, are very important, are critical to eliminating any further pollution. We have a major problem with 240,000 barrels on the water. If it became 1,240,000 barrels, we would have 5 times the problem. The third task, that is recovering the oil that was released immediately after the grounding, is not proceeding well. Believe me, that's an understatement. I'd like to cover the good news first, then the bad news, and I know you want to concentrate on the bad news, so we'll, I don't mean that facetiously. Obviously, that's the one that everyone wants to understand. Believe me, the media folks have been wonderful. I have no complaint. I've seen people being chased down the street with microphones. I got to tell you, I can tell you so many pleasant stories about media support. If I got into it, I'd get choked up, so I don't want to do it. But believe me, it is happening every single time. And I need it. And that's why I asked Don to make that statement. It helps. Believe me, it helps. Exxon's response team now numbers 131 in total. 54 of those are Exxon employees. The rest are experts that we have hired from all over the U.S. and the United Kingdom, and I believe there's one gentleman from Rotterdam also. And all of these 131 people, they are either managing, supervising, or giving expert advice on all the different facets of this enormous recovery we're trying to mount. We have also developed and it's very important, we have also developed a very cooperative working effort with the state officials, with the federal officials, the Coast Guard, NOAA, EPA, and it is just very, very helpful. I mean, we are just in constant communication and working together with each step. I'll talk about the transfer and update you. As of 8 p.m. tonight, we will have 120,000 barrels transferred off of the damaged vessel and onto the Exxon Baton Rouge. That represents 12% of the cargo that was on board, still on board following the grounding. Right now we have 4 submersible pumps in operation. We have 3 additional pumps that are now on the deck of the vessel, and they're in the process of being hooked up for transfer, and by Tuesday morning we'll have a total of 7 pumps in operation. We have 4 more submersible pumps being air freighted and trucked in. We will have those 4 additional pumps in operation by Wednesday morning. At that point we'll have 11 submersible pumps transferring cargo to the Baton Rouge. We're also air freighting in a larger diameter transfer hose and in an effort to get even further increase the transfer rate. So far that operation is going very well. I'll talk a little bit about the salvage effort itself. We've engaged a salvage expert to help the Exxon personnel develop alternatives for salvaging the vessel and doing it safely. In the process, we have confirmed that one of the cargo tanks, it's the aftermost one on the starboard side, is intact. I think last night I told you we were a little questionable, we weren't sure, but that cargo tank is intact. The one just forward of it, two forward of it, which is a ballast tank, number 4 starboard ballast tank. We are able to maintain that tank empty by using the ship's eductor system to keep up with the water that's leaking into that tank. Must be a very small crack. We are also able to maintain partial buoyancy on the number 2 starboard ballast tank. Now, just let me tell you that all these are very, very positive steps, because the major problem we faced when we got here in regard to the vessel was that we had no buoyancy along the starboard side and no buoyancy along the center. The vessel was floating on the starboard tanks and the pinnacle it was resting on and the engine room space. At least that's what we thought. Now, by confirming that we have at least 2 full tanks on the starboard side that we can maintain buoyancy and an additional tank that we can maintain partial buoyancy, that is a major step forward. Makes a big change in how we're going to address that salvage. One of the things that's being hampered today by the weather, and there are many, many things that are being hampered by the very high winds we have, is that we weren't able to put the divers in the water to help us get a much better understanding of the shape of the pinnacle that the vessel's on. And we'll be able to do that tomorrow. I'll just update some facts, some figures, give you an idea of what's in place. We presently have rigged on boats 9,300 feet of 18-inch boom. All of that, unfortunately, is weatherbound in the lee side of Bligh Island. We are presently reeling in a 4,800-foot CPAC, also because of the weather. We are attempting to redeploy the boom around the vessel. It was damaged in the high winds. We have on site Looks like 20,000 feet approximately of boom. There's another 6,000 in the staging area. And this is all 18-inch boom, and that's the type of boom we need right now. We've got 57,000 barrels, or 57,000 maybe pounds, or I don't know, pollution cleanup equipment, especially adapted for beach cleanup, and that's also its staging area. We've got 2 truckloads of beach cleanup equipment en route from the Anchorage stockpile. And that'll be enough to keep about 60 people busy. I'm going to save that one for a minute. As of Sunday, we had boomed the leading edge of the slick in 2 critical areas, and we were carrying out mechanical skimming. We also were deploying boom along the most sensitive areas of the east side of the slick. We also had a couple good things happen on Sunday. We had a successful burn test of a segment of the oil slick late Saturday afternoon. And on Sunday afternoon, we received permission from the state officials to conduct burning of isolated segments of the slick, especially at the leading edge where it was threatening environmentally sensitive areas. We also had on Sunday a successful demonstration of aerial spray of oil dispersant. We evaluated the results along with the state officials and the Coast Guard, and we received concurrence from the state officials at 6:45 p.m. last night to begin to employ oil dispersants in Zone 1 only. Zone 1 is the area of deepest water and least environmental sensitivity, but that was fine with us because that's where most of the oil was as of sunset on Sunday. This time Sunday evening we were elated. I mean, my guys were sky high because for the first time beginning at daybreak Monday, we would finally be able to attack this enormous slick with all our available resources and recovery techniques. The weather report indicated an average wind velocity of 25 knots with gusts of 35 on Sunday evening and Monday morning. And that's kind of marginal for small boat operation, but it's manageable safely. At 9 p.m., we received an alert from the weather station that the gusts would reach 50 knots. That's beyond what we feel is a safe sort of situation. I'm going to ad-lib from here on because I didn't have time to prepare my notes. So from here on, I'm going to do the best I can. I may have some figures wrong. I'm sure you'll remind me of them a few days from now. So we had to shut down the skimming operations, and we had to get the people and the boats and the skimmers into safe lee. We did that very successfully. No one was hurt, no boats were damaged, no skimmers were damaged. However, some boom was damaged. The winds actually reached 73 miles per hour early Monday morning. I understand a large section of the roof at the terminal at the airport blew off. We had a very, very precarious situation in the middle of the night with a number of helicopters that were out at the airport. And thanks to the vigilance of the Valdez police and some heroics by them and representatives from the Department of Environmental Conservation, who all of whom literally were holding down the airplanes with their hands until they could get sandbags in place. We still have all the helicopters, and that's very crucial because we need them all. As of daybreak this morning, the FAA had grounded all helicopters and planes. We were not able to get anything in the air until after 10 a.m. I left the morning press conference, and the first thing that I did was review the results of the aerial overflights. At about the same time, I got a call from Admiral Nelson, who was reviewing the results of the Coast Guard overflights. And just about everybody's been in crisis management since that time. What happened was our worst fears, and that those very high winds last night, gusts up to 73 miles an hour, essentially stampeded that slick out of the center of Prince William Sound over to the western edge and down in a essentially southwesterly direction. It's unbelievable. That slick is moving like it's on a superhighway. The Coast Guard estimates that from sundown Sunday until they did their overflight, or perhaps it was until their middle of the afternoon overflight, that slick had moved 30 miles, the leading edge of it. We were able to get one dispersant plane in the air and to drop one load, that's 5,500 gallons in zone one. We did that mid-afternoon. As a result of our further tracking of the slick, and I'll get into that a little bit, the Coast Guard requested and the regional response team agreed to attempt some further use of dispersants in a zone three area, which requires the highest level of approval. That was granted late in the afternoon. I don't know if we got the dispersant on the slick. The leading edge of the slick now is in the vicinity of Knight Island. It's moving in a southwesterly direction in the general direction of Montague Straits. We have oil now ashore at Smith Island, Eleanor Island, Ingot Island, and along the southeast edge. I didn't see that. It's along the northeast and east edges of Naked Island. We have brought in, and we did this Sunday, brought in a special tracking system, airborne tracking system, and a Canadian expert, Dr. Ron Goodman, and he will be up first light overfly and assess the spill extent. The device that is on the airplane monitors precisely the spill boundaries and its concentrations. That's something we initiated either Saturday or Sunday, I don't recall, but he arrived this afternoon and he'll be up and running tomorrow morning. The weather forecast calls for moderating winds, but it still looks like it's going to be marginal for mechanical cleanup. We are planning to conduct burning under the permit we have in some of the most threatened areas. I spent 2 hours in a Coast Guard helicopter with Admiral Nelson and a representative of the Department of Environmental Conservation, and also one other gentleman, I believe he represented NOAA. I was very silent for 2 hours because we got a mess on our hands down the westernmost edge of Prince William Sound. We have a lot of the slick has turned into what they call chocolate mousse. The rest of it is spread out in sort of stampede fashion, but it's all moving now in a, rectangle, which is relatively narrow but very long. In essentially a southwesterly direction. So the tools at hand to us right now are principally burning. We are attempting to redeploy all of our boom. The problem is we've got to go approximately 40 miles. And in fact, we need to chase that spill as it runs down that superhighway. But we are mobilizing to move that boom. We can use only our larger boats to do that because they have to cross that 40 miles of Prince William Sound. And we'll be setting up cleaning operations on those islands. I'm ready to address questions.
Mr. Russell.
Yes.
Since 1984, Mr. Hazelwood has been convicted of driving while intoxicated at least three times. This includes an accident with injuries and an incident last fall in which his license was revoked.
I really don't want to comment.
Why was he allowed to continue in command of an Exxon tanker under those circumstances?
To my knowledge, Exxon has no knowledge of those incidents. And that's all I'm going to say.
Mr. Cornell, you said that you had completed the preliminary stage of the internal investigation. Putting aside the issue of whether or not your skipper was intoxicated, could you tell us, please, or answer this simple question, why was that skipper not on the deck when it was going through this portion of the sound where he was uniquely qualified to guide it? Have you asked him that?
Well, I have not personally talked to the captain, but I would remind you of what I told you a while ago. We have given you all of the information that we have that is appropriate for us to discuss. This is a 20-year employee, and his career is at stake. And there are five investigations underway. And the gentleman with the information about the drunk driving arrests, I would suggest that you give that to the National Transportation Safety Board or someone else who's conducting an investigation. We do not intend to comment on Captain Hazelwood any further.
Why not? Mr. Cornett,
it is not appropriate. That's why not.
You tantalize us with saying that you have an investigation underway, etc., and then you refuse to give us the conclusions. There is no law barring you from revealing your private company's investigation to these reporters here. And we wonder what you're hiding, sir. There's no law against you revealing this. Please do,
sir.
So. Give us the facts, please.
Sir, this investigation is being conducted by attorneys. They're is attorney-client privilege. There, we conduct investigations of every accident in this company, and we don't reveal that information to the public. The National Transportation Safety Board, the state of Alaska, there are four outside of our investigation, there are four investigations that are going on that will produce results that will be made available to you, and we do not mean to tantalize you. We have tried to answer your questions.
Then don't bring it up here then, please, because now we're really curious and we really do want to find out.
Well, we really will tell you at the right time.
You're stonewalling, sir. I'm sorry. Does Exxon have a policy with the move to the tanker itself?
In 1972, I read that it was testified that the TAPS fleet would, quote, set new and exacting standards to govern the marine transportation of American oil, and that the then environmental secretary testified that the newly constructed vessels would be required to have segregated ballast systems incorporating a double bottom. And did this ship have any of those features, and if not, what happened to that promise?
I really don't know where that statement on double bottoms came from. I'd tell you right now that probably 90% of the vessels in this service do not have double bottoms in the cargo section. Looking at the damage, I don't believe it would have done any good. I mean, the indents are enormous. There's a tunnel, basically, that you could drive a car through. I don't have anything to do with it.
You're not familiar with congressional testimony at which Alaska Pipeline Service gave evidence?
Certainly not in 1972. And I'm not part of Alaska Pipeline Company, so I certainly don't follow.
Could you explain to us the policy, therefore, on the construction of these ships?
This is the newest vessel. I'm sorry, it's the second newest because it has a sister ship that came out 3 months after this one. It was built and construction was completed in December of 1986. It is built to the highest standards and highest requirements of the U.S. Coast Guard and the American Bureau of Shipping and to just about any other standards worldwide. It has segregated ballast, and that's, I refer to that when I talk about the number two port and starboard and the number four port and starboard ballast tanks. It also has a forward ballast tank, but that was the first tank ruptured in the incident. It has a double bottom in way of the engine room, and the aftermost cargo tanks on the port and starboard side. It does not have a double bottom in way of the main cargo section, and there are no standards that require it.
Mr. Ross,
none.
What's the Zone 3 area in which you've gained permission to use dispersants?
It's an area around Smith Island, around Seal Island, north of Green Island. There is an area that has been drawn of approximately a mile around all of those sensitive areas. So it's Zone 3, but it's in a very defined geography, which is less sensitive than closer to the islands. So we are staying as far, and the permission was only for two applications, if we could get them in tonight. It's not a blanket authority, and it's not something that anyone would want to do. It is a measure of last resort. All that beach area is being impacted. We have no other tool at this point because we can't skim, because the winds are too high, and we can't burn because the winds are too high. We're setting up for a burning first thing in the morning, and hopefully the winds will be lower.
And as far as the continuing use of the, if I may, as far as the continuing use of the of dispersants, are you at all concerned that this continuing high winds and the wave action are going to basically put you in a situation where you're not going to be able to use dispersants because the oil will be clumping and turning into chocolate mousse, as you've already said it's doing on the leading edge?
Well, there are differences of opinion as to whether the dispersant is effective on what they call mousse. We hope to test and find out. There is a lot of it out there. We don't have any in Zone 1, but we certainly have some spread out everywhere. So if we didn't do it tonight, then we have to reassess the situation tomorrow, and we have to go back through the approval process, starting with the Coast Guard and then into the regional response team. The regional response team, as you may remember, is comprised of a number of representatives from a number of federal and state agencies. And they have to give us concurrence for the use of dispersants and anything other than Zone 1. We received authority late Sunday afternoon, early evening Sunday, to use dispersants in Zone 1. Unfortunately, on Monday morning, our target had gotten away from us.
There was a question up here. I'd like to take.
Thank you. You described burning as a primary tool, but today the NOAA oceanographer, Jerry Galt, who overflew the area, said that the oil is so spread out now in streamers and windrows that it's virtually impossible to burn. Do you still see burning as a major cleanup?
He was probably looking at a different part of the slick than the Coast Guard and I. There is an enormous pileup on the northern side of Smith Island, an enormous pileup of mousse. And it's just continuing to come in. And we never had a better area to, I say we, but I want to go back and tell you that this is the first oil spill I've ever addressed in person, although I've been involved in planning and actually had a lot to do with the type of organization that you now see. However, this is the first time I've been involved. So in the past, the other folks who have been in the position that I'm in have never had the opportunity to burn as well as that area north of Smith Island.
That's just one area overall, do you still see yourself being able to burn as much as the oil, of the oil as you thought you were going to be able to burn?
Well, the first, you know, we've always said that what we wanted to do was employ all three techniques, because each of the three techniques has a better chance of working under certain conditions. None of the three are ideal, and that's why you need to work them in combination and pick out the best possible alternative for each given circumstance. North of Smith Island is a perfect place. It's not going to solve the problem, certainly, but you know, every little bit's going to help. We got to do everything we can. Yes, sir.
Yesterday you said that 3,000 barrels had been recovered. Could you tell us what percentage of that was water content, and did you factor that in?
That's total oil. And that comes from the barge, the measurements of the barge, and taking water cuts, but it's 3,000 barrels of oil.
Your beach cleaning crews you mentioned, where are they being deployed, how many people are there, when will they begin?
They haven't had time to review the specific sites that the experts have picked out, but that's being done in conjunction with the Coast Guard and with the DEC. I imagine they're going to be down in the area of Naked Island and Eleanor Island. One of the local gentlemen warned me about the bears, and I told him, please tell the right people, but right now bears don't bother me.
How many people?
I'm sure they can bother the people that are on site.
How many people are you deploying?
All of the people that we can employ in the beach areas. You know, we have not put any limit on people. What we've been doing is hiring people as we have something for them to do. And up until Sunday, we had very little to do other than around Bly Island, and that's where we were deploying the first crews. I have to tell you that tomorrow morning we're going to have a lot more to do, unfortunately.
I noticed today two school buses full of what looked like workers spent most of the day sitting in town, I guess waiting to be sent out. Was there some reason that they weren't sent out, and what were they to do?
Because we have to move those people by boat, and we didn't have any small boat operations all day because of the weather.
And they were to go clean beaches? Was that what they were?
I don't know specifically what those people were assigned to, but you know, there's nothing for work crews to do in Valdez, no matter whether they're employing boom or whether they're cleaning beach. We need to get them out to the islands around Prince William Sound. Everything needs to go by small boat, and the weather has just totally shut us down.
What's the timetable for it hitting the island, Naked Island?
Just as soon as we can get people there.
No, the oil. When's it going?
The oil.
As soon as we can get it there.
I don't know a specific timetable. Everybody's working on it right now.
It's going to hit that island first?
Oh, it's hit Naked Island. That was the first it was hit. And when we overflew it, the impacted area was the northeast edge and the eastern edge. The slick actually kind of rode down that alleyway. Yes.
I have a question, and it basically may seem a little premature, but historically, when there have been oil spills, they have found that the recovery time is not measured in 1 year. They have found that the recovery time may be measured in 6 years or longer. This is back in Torrey Canyon days and that. What I'm interested in, and this is from the aspect of Exxon and the other regulatory agencies, is once, and let's say you're successful, let's use the best case scenario. You empty the tanker out, no more oil is spilled, you float the tanker, you get it out of here, you get a new bottom put on it, and everything goes back to normal. And you disperse the oil, you burn the oil, or it flows out through Hinchinbrock entrance out into the Sound. And it's gone from sight. My question is who is going to be responsible for monitoring the recovery of Prince William Sound for the next 10 years or more? Because that, I think, is what's going to take, because this is such an enclosed area. And I wondered if, and you were saying you were doing planning before the spills, is this part of your plan, is to monitor this over years?
Let me address your question. It's a very good question. If I were in your place, I'd be asking all the same kind of questions you are. Let me address it in two aspects. first cleaning, or we're going to get it cleaned up. If it takes months, many months, it'll go on. Secondly, yesterday we initiated a combined environmental impact study in conjunction with state agencies and federal agencies. And this study is really to gather data on what the impact is and what's happening. I imagine that kind of study will be going on for a long time. And that's, see, what we're doing right now, fortunately there's good baseline data, so you need to study the impact, you need baseline. We have good baseline data, and we'll be studying the impacts, and that's the sort of time-related study that'll continue on for a long time, I'm sure.
Basically, what you're saying then is that you have something going now, and there will be responsible, or somebody will be responsible over the next, we could perceivably say a decade or more, to look at the recovery at various parts of the biota out there.
Yes, whatever it takes to get the relevant data.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Aras?
Yes.
Do you have any figures in terms of the number of miles of coastline that are affected? And do you have any predictions on how many might be affected? And thirdly, are you aware of the fact that Prince William Sound has over 2,500 miles of coastline, and if, in worst case scenario, the whole thing were affected, it would be equivalent to cleaning up the coast, entire coast of California? Are you willing to commit yourself to that?
I don't think we're going to see the entire coast. We're going to see that channel that runs down to the west of Montague Island and then out into the ocean. We're going to see that area impacted, but the way that the slick is moving, I understand it's caught the natural circulation currents that come in through Hinchinbrook and then wrap themselves around and go out that body of water just to the west of Montague Island. And that's one of the reasons why it's moving so fast. The other reason is that the wind velocity, the wind direction is essentially paralleling that current, so it's getting a push both from the current and from the wind. And boy, it's galloping down there. So I don't think we're talking about all Prince William Sound, but we're talking about a lot of coast. I have no way around it.
About the ship itself, about what time did it move last night? Did you consider evacuation? What kind of status is it in right now?
I don't know exactly what time it was, but I understand the highest gusts were about 2 a.m. Both the vessel and both the Exxon Valdez and the Exxon Baton Rouge swung around about 12 degrees to the north. For those folks that were on board, it was not a very enjoyable ride. We are employing every precaution for their safety. They're never more than a few inches away from their survival gear. There's a lot of pressure on those folks. They're doing a lot of work. The high winds are driving sea spray, frozen sea spray, onto the deck where they're trying to work. You know, it's nothing short of heroics right now there. I think the thing that's buoying them right now is that they see progress and they see success, and we are all beginning to feel that we're getting our arms around that part of it.
Frank,
yes, sir.
Where your handout promises? Excuse me, my voice is gone. Where your handout promises?
Let me fix
you some more. The last 2 years, I made over $250,000 a year fishing this area. And when you're making promises, I just want to hear something that I'm going to keep making $250,000 a year. Why I broke them by the crumb, you know, you took our resources and washed them down the sink. And I want some promises saying that it ain't going away. Because, you know, I've been making big money because it's clean, not because it's got oil on top.
I understand your concern, and keep on top of it. I tell you every reasonable thing, and the reason I have to say reasonable is because you always get in this situation a number of speculative claims. But if it reaches a reasonable man's definition of a reasonable claim, well, we're going to cover it.
Sorry, how do you make a reasonable claim for a marine
mammals and seabirds. I know we can make claims for fish that's lost, but I mean, how do you place value on marine mammals and seabirds?
Fortunately, I think up to this point there's been very, very little impact. I don't have a count.
But I mean, it's on the beach now.
One of the good things happening is that those kind of things are not happening. That doesn't mean that we won't get.
Have world wildlife.
Well, there'll be some impact, and there are techniques, I believe, for addressing that.
And
I'm not an expert in what they are.
Okay, is when you send out your beach cleanup crews, are you going to be sending out crews to clean up wildlife as well?
Yes, we have two rescue centers, one for birds and one for marine mammals. And we've got two of the country's experts, not Exxon people, really environmental experts in bird cleanup. I think that's Alice Berkner. And in mammal cleanup, I think it's Dr. Raymond, last name escapes me, but well known for it. Yes, Randall Davis. Okay, thank you. Yeah, could I, first let me just say that I really got a crisis on my hands, so I'm going to take two more questions. You first, sir.
Your best guess estimate, how much of this 240,000 will you never get your hands on?
Well, you know, fortunately, a segment of it and a significant segment of it vaporized and is still vaporizing. If you have overflown that area at any time in the past 3 days, you have no doubt it is vaporizing. I think I almost got sick in a helicopter because the door was partly open for 2 hours. I know what the young lady is talking about who this morning mentioned the need to protect the people who are working in that area. So a major segment of it is already vaporized. The experts could tell you how much, I don't know. A certain portion of it has already degraded biologically, and the what's there still, I don't know. I have to tell you, it's a lot. You know, we are dealing with the largest spill that this country's ever seen.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, could I take one more? I heard a voice here, yes.
Your comment on something, and it's in regard to what Mr. Ben said also. When we spoke with your claims people, I'm losing track of days, yesterday, the day before, we mentioned that we would like to have some sort of foundation set up that would be funded by you, that it's guaranteed that they would be here for the next 10 years to determine what sorts of losses are incurred. In other words, give the proper people who will be able to say how many fish didn't show up because this happened. You know, that's real hard to determine, and it's going to be hard to determine what's a reasonable claim unless we have a number of people who are qualified to determine that.
Yeah, the claims organization that's being set up outboard of all this response organization, well, it's not outboard of the response organization because it really is part of the response, but we've got a distinct claims organization and it's growing every day. As a result of last night's winds, it's going to grow a lot more, and they're going to need to address the type of questions you have. You know, I just don't have an answer for you right now. But hang on, because I haven't failed you. I lost your attention. Okay, thank you, Don, I'll see you tomorrow morning, and I'll see you tomorrow night.
That was Frank Arasi, president of Exxon Shipping, speaking at a press conference in the Valdez Civic Center Auditorium, or rather Civic Center Ballroom, the site for most of the press conferences that have put together in response to the Exxon Valdez grounding. The conference tonight started with a statement by Don Cornett, who's the head of the Exxon office in Anchorage, Alaska. He is over here to assist with the handling of the press and these conferences to allow Mr. Arasi more time to deal with the management of the crisis. Don Cornett statement beginning the conference essentially was a defense of the use of dispersants, and a reminder that oil is in fact biodegradable, and that his assertion is that the dispersants assist in the biodegradation of the spilled oil. Frank Arossi then took the stand and gave basically the evening situation report. Admittedly, the report was there's good news and bad news. The good news basically relates to the salvage efforts to get the oil off of the Exxon Valdez, which is still hard aground on the reef. The bad news is that the winds of today and last night have basically taken what was a fairly confined oil slick in the center of Prince William Sound and moved it rapidly 30 miles in less than 12 hours to the southwest toward toward a series of islands. Now that, unlike yesterday, we now have a situation where many beaches are impacted and many more will be as the oil works its way to the southwest corner of Prince William Sound and out into the Gulf of Alaska. The quote was, "The worst fears have been realized. The slick is moving away." Tomorrow's weather is anticipated to be marginal for mechanical cleanup. Dispersants will continue to be used, and also they're anticipating tomorrow, weather permitting, a major attempt at a burn just north of the Smith Island, where a large buildup of oil is occurring. Oil and in the oil mixed with water form known that they're being referred to as the chocolate mousse. The questions tonight were very much followed the line of questioning that has been consistent throughout these series of conferences. A number of pointed and direct questions about the role of the master of the vessel and the third mate were put off by Exxon officials, saying that since the NTSB is in town conducting an investigation, they're going to make no more statements relating to the captain, his role, or any alleged or validated history of drinking problems. The other questions have to do with impact, whether or not dispersants would be effective, and again, people in the community, the Prince William Sound community, fishermen especially, questioning the depth of commitment by Exxon to truly providing reimbursement or protection to the various fishing interests, the processors, the fishermen, related industries that may well be impacted in the long term by these events. There are no more events scheduled for this evening. Press events tomorrow. We're expecting a Coast Guard briefing in the morning. The 11 o'clock Exxon briefing tomorrow will be by Don Cornett. Frank Arossi will be available only in the evening briefing. Tomorrow night, Exxon says they will have their evening briefing, which has been scheduled repeatedly for 5 o'clock, but is yet to occur at that time. They will hold it at 5 because many members of the industry response team will be going to Cordova, where a town meeting has been scheduled. Citizens of Cordova, of course, are as affected as the community of Valdez by the oil spill. In fact, due to the predominance of fisheries as the main economic activity in Cordova, one could say that possibly, in a worst-case scenario, the impact could be even more devastating on that community than Valdez. Tomorrow night, there will be representatives of the various response teams at the meeting in Cordova, an attempt by the folks here at the various agencies and industry groups to provide some information to that community and, of course, I think to listen to some input. Tomorrow night here in Valdez at 8 p.m., NOAA has announced they will have a press conference at 8 p.m. NOAA is the lead organization for the federal government in assessing the environmental impact, and that meeting should begin to have some definitive statements by NOAA as to how they assess the damage. KCHU will be continuing to cover these meetings and providing the broadcast coverage of the meetings to our listeners, and we'll also be continue to feed these meetings to those stations around the state and the nation who are interested in carrying them. I want to thank tonight volunteers from the public radio station here in Valdez, Tucker Spohr, Lee Schmetline, Kim Hartman, for their assistance in these broadcasts. Engineering the broadcast back at KCHU Studios has been Laura Lee. I'm Dave Hammack, and this is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.